Hello and welcome back to the Skeptance podcast with me, your host, Paul Richards. Whilst we're busy recording season two here at Third Floor Recording in London, we've picked out some of our favourite moments from season one. Coming up, you'll hear interviews with Bell and Sebastian, Ellis James, Sorry and Manic Street Preachers, plus The National, Warren Ellis, Billy Martin and Sleaford Mods. You mentioned the Tindersticks and Pulp as contemporaries that you absolutely loved at the time, but do you feel that after the first two albums came out that you were part of something, or that you were these complete outsiders looking in?
We weren't even part of something in Glasgow. I mean, especially in Glasgow, you know, it was like, get to fuck. I mean, it's funny because Edwin Collins said a funny thing the other day. He said, you know, somebody pointed out that he'd said something rather nasty about another band in, you know, back in 1981 or something. And he said, well, that's what people did. That was what the scene was like back then. You know, it was catty. It was backbiting and everybody was looking over their shoulders. And so I'm not saying it was like that so much in Glasgow. I just felt I was completely isolated. I do tell a story sometimes where, you know, people got so used to me asking them to be in my band that they would cross the street. I saw like hipsters, cool people, me a body swerve in Barge Road and crossing the street because they thought this guy's going to fucking ask me to be in his band again. It was that ridiculous. You know, and I remember being up at the art school and chatting to somebody and they said, well, what are you up to? And I said, well, I'm trying to get a band together. And this person, I can't remember who it was just like, why would you do that? There's too many bands. Why would you do that? Like, are you going to be as good as the Small Faces? So fucking forget it, you know? Who do you think you are? Why do you think a wee prick from Glasgow can do anything? So that was the prevailing attitude. And the nice thing about the Bells, when you look back in it now, I mean, we're fucking misfits. When you see the ragtag bunch that got together to do this college project, this school project, I mean, it's a brilliant origin story because none of those guys were in the cool set. We're complete ragtag. And I loved that. I loved it. It was, instead of me having to chase people, Bell and Sebastian were actually the first seven people through the door. It was the first seven people that I ran into when I was asked by Stoke College to make a record.
Can you remember what your expectations were at the beginning? Did you have any grand plans, or was it, let's just make an album?
At this point, I didn't think it could be a group that would be a going concern. I just want to make a record. That's all I wanted to do. That's all I had the provision in my mind to do. I was still, you know, weak with ME, so I was so limited. But I thought I could make a record. I thought I could make a record. I thought, you know, I could control the whole thing, and these guys would come in. And so that was it. Yeah, we managed that. But it surprised me that, you know, after we did that, we were kind of like, I think me and Chris and Isabel, you went on a drive to the countryside like the day after Tiger Milk. They were kind of like, okay, so what's happening? What's next? And I was like, I don't know. but it was kind of great, you know, because we did have a sense. Most of us, you know, particularly those guys and me, who had the sense we'd actually done something that was completely surprising. You know, Chris never thought, he would have made a record. And Isabel was, at that point, she was delighted to be in the studio. At that point, Jackson was this sort of unknown factor because he was the one thing I couldn't really get a handle on. I didn't really know how he did what he did, or it was terrific, you know, that was the great thing about his guitar. He just seemed to be able to pick it up and it sounded like a full meal. It sounded like a band all on its own. And so Jackson was the kind of the X factor on Tiger Milk, and where, you know, everybody, you know, we placed everything else around that. And so, but with Sinister, I wanted to do, I was getting a little bit more ambitious, wanted to make more use of the cello, violin and trumpet arrangements, wanted them to be a little bit more considered. I think, you know, on Tiger Milk, we recorded the four guys and then maybe added some, you know, strings afterwards. I wrote all the songs for sinister in a really short period of time. I mean, the band sort of really only got together at the start of 96. We recorded Tiger Milk in March, but I'd started writing the songs for Sinister around about, actually in probably February. I wrote Fox and the Snow and Stars, the Track and Field, the same day, I think. And, you know, I wrote that those songs a really short period of time. The last song I wrote was Judy and the Dream of Horses, which is more like in the spring. And so we rehearsed a little bit more. I remember rehearsing with Isabel on her own and maybe Chris on his own for a bit and thinking about the parts a bit more. But instead of Rattlesnakes as a, I guess my benchmark for Sinister was Tapestry and Court and Spark. I had two little benchmarks. And of course, you know, those LPs were recorded by seasoned artists with the best session musicians, with careful production. You know, there was a lot, there's obviously so much experience and know-how went into the making of those records. And so it was a high thing to aim for, and we fell short. But the falling short was all in my department, because I had this overarching sense that I had to do everything quickly. If I didn't do everything quickly, they were going to stop me. I'd been waiting for this moment for so long. You know, I didn't want to wrest any control. Sinister was at the height of my tunnel vision and just wanted to get it done. And I felt that if I didn't do it quickly, we felt this pressure, because at this point we actually had a record label called Jeepster. You know, those guys were like, you know, they kept phoning up on the first day and said, "Well, how many reels of tapes have you used? You know, like, you know, we can't afford that much tape." And it just, I already felt this pressure, you know, it was all the pressure was on me, obviously. And you know, I was just thinking, oh, fuck off, just let me get on with it. That was the vibe around Sinister. And of course, you got the group where they weren't just marionettes. They were living people, and they had their own opinions. And you know, suddenly during the course of the year, the personality of this band started to appear. And you know, by the end of the year, everything was ripped up. I mean, the kind of idea that I had of a group of that being this controlled thing, this baroque thing, was completely torn to shreds by the next by the next recording session.
So by the time you're, you know, properly in a band and you're starting to play gigs, where is your music taste? Have we sort of moved on from that kind of era, or you know, are other band members sort of handing you things? You know, probably a CD at the time, of saying, put this in your Sony Discman.
I was into Radiohead. I really loved the Bends and OK Computer. The problem with OK Computer, though, was that something like Paranoid Android, for instance, isn't quite an odd time signature. So you think, all right, well, maybe not. So I was in a band when I was 17 or 18, and what we liked doing was annoying people. So it was very psychedelic and lots of feedback and recorders and backwards keyboards and stuff. Because obviously when you've grown up in West Wales, there's a scarcity of places to play. So like you'd have to end up, you'd end up playing in rugby clubs and things in front of the rugby team, who just stand in there in their suits, drinking pints, just staring at you like, what the hell is this? So that was good fun. But then I stopped doing it when I was at university, and then I started another band when I was, I was asked to join another band when I was about 25. And that was really good fun, because the other three had all been in really serious groups. So Mike, who was the bassist, had been in a band called Mobishopi, who were the second band to be signed to V2 after the Stereophonics, and they'd been Radio 1 Single of the Week. And then Gemma, the singer, she was in a really great group called Sammo Hung, who were asked to support Bloc Party and Franz Ferdinand and stuff. But then they split up at a really crucial time. But I used to really love Sammo Hung. And then our friend Moggs, who was the drummer, had been in one of the offshoot bands from McCluskey when McCluskey had split up. So the other three were really experienced and had been there and done it, and I hadn't. It was really fun, and I loved playing music, but you realise how committed all bands have got to be, because the amount of stuff you end up doing for nothing. And even when you're doing cool stuff, you're not getting paid very much. Like, we were on, we did a six music session and stuff, and we supported The Fall.
Oh, wow. How was that?
Amazing. And, you know, it was quite, we loved The Fall, as, you know, the four of us. And so that was a really big moment for us. We played Glastonbury, actually. We played the 2007 or 2008 Glastonbury. But the thing is, when we did the six music session, I think we got £350. Like, there was four of us in the group. It's not even a hundred quid each. And as a teenager, I remember hearing bands listening to bands who might do an evening session. I assume they were all multimillionaires. Like, I genuinely thought, if you're on Radio 1, you've made it. You live in a castle, you've got a swimming pool, you've got a jacuzzi, you've probably got a chef, you're driving around Ferraris. It's just, it couldn't be further from the truth. And it was a very instructive time in that sense, because you realise there's a few bands at the top ruining an absolute fortune and everyone else is just trying their hardest to get by. And it made it appear a lot less glamorous, actually. I still loved writing songs. I still loved playing guitar and being in a band. But you think, oh, fuck, all the stuff I loved and have loved since I was about 14. Christ, this...
So you're like still like mid to late 20s at this point?
So that band split up when I was about 27, I think. Because by that point, I was going full-time as a comic, so I couldn't really do both.
Ah, so was that the fork in the road for you? Was it kind of, there's one path here and there's another path here? And I need to pick one.
Because it's, you know, there are lots of, or well, there certainly were then, non-famous stand-up comics who earned a living. So I thought, well, I'm, you know, it looks like I'm going to be one of those. And that's fine by me. And I was going out with a singer and we split up. And then the other two, I think, I mean, it's a long time ago, but not now. But the thing with comedy was, as well, you're not dividing everything four ways. And you're not reliant on the other three's diaries, all that kind of stuff. And there's an awful, like, I hadn't realised until I was in a band that was being taken seriously, how much admin there is.
Yeah, I have no idea how bands function.
It blows my mind. Yeah.
I don't know how you get three, four, five people agreeing on that many things at once.
Polyphonic Spree. How are they doing it?
How does that work?
There's about 50 of them.
Is it like a, you know, polling system of, you know, majority wins? I don't know. Think of that Echoes video. Mm. It really reminded me of this Manic Street Preachers photo shoot
That's a Melody Maker shoot
from 1993, where the two male figures are painted in gold.
Yeah.
Which is very similar to the Echoes video.
Yeah, I never seen that as well. Yeah. So that's really cool. I need to check this out.
So where did you get that from?
Well, wanted it to be twins, because like identical twins, because I think the idea of the song is sort of, well, the original idea was going to be twins and one of them's changing, and we thought, like, how could we make them change? And you couldn't really, wanted it to kind of not decipher, you wouldn't really be able to decipher which one is changing, and it's sort of sad as well. And then I was with my friend who did the movement directing, we were talking, I was like, it does need to have more of a narrative. And I was also trying to incorporate, wanted it to be statues, like, in... And we were just going to shoot it in London or go to like Dungeness or something. And then suddenly it all came in one go. Like, oh, this could be the story. This could be really cool. Yeah. Like the idea that they're both kind of just, they're gold, you know, they go out and do gold statue. But then one of them starts turning blue, has to leave and wants to go and be free. But then the other one sort of finds him and then they don't. And one of them kind of disappears. And then literally just in the net, we had the idea 2 weeks before, and then my friend Seb, he's really cool, he's from Brussels, he's really good DOP, and he did the filming for Hot Freaks. So this is another video, but he's just so sick and has such good energy, and I called him, I was like, oh, do you want to films video. He's like, I'm doing a cycling trip around France with my sister. He was like, but I am going to be in France around this. And I was like, oh, should we just do it in France? That would be so fun. He was like, yeah. So we just went. And he was really cool, actually, because he's got this sort of monastery. He had a friend who has this monastery near Marseille. And so we stayed there. And they were really sweet. They do like arts, like kind of art stuff. It was just like perfect. And then we just put these twins from Paris just replied to our story. And they were just like so up for it. They just came and the day before. And it was just really fun and sort of, it was cute. Yeah.
So these group of songs, Jive, Echoes, Today Might Be the Hit, are all from your upcoming album, Cosplay.
Mm-hmm.
What can you tell us about the album?
The last album was quite emotional and like songy and light. We wanted to make it more live with the band. And but afterwards we kind of felt like the production and sort of the impact maybe felt not lost, like it was good for that, but we wanted to bring it back. So when we actually started to, we wanted to merge our product, we wanted our production to be more prominent in it. And then we were going to record it with Dan Kerry. We went into the studio really early, like this was like a year and a half ago. And I was like, we don't have the songs yet, like it's not. And so it kind of flopped, but it was kind of good because then we just recorded the songs over and over. So they kind of had time to grow and then wrote around them. And then we had to find, and I lost my mind so much in this album because I was like, what is the string? For me, it's really important for me to understand what is the whole meaning of this world, love, this, what's it? And because all the songs felt really different, because he like recorded differently and like the genre feels quite different in each of them to me at the time. So then we were kind of wanted to know how to string it together. And then kind of had this idea of, I actually got, my friend took me to Spider-Verse, with an orchestra, because she knows the guy who does the orchestra. And then us two seats down was Adam Curtis. And then we ended up by having a pint with him. And I already had the idea of cosplay in my head and how kind of, because I feel like, everyone feels like that, but it's just like a bit lost in time. And sort of there's all these genres, but you kind of don't feel, like you can almost try things on, but they're not, they don't really feel, well, that's my experience, it doesn't feel like you're innately one of them and everyone feels a bit janked out. And it's sort of how to paint with those in a way that feels new and like actually you're not, you're just stealing in plain sight because it's like you're really like contextualizing it rather than it. I don't know. I feel like the references and like some pop culture is so far away from what it meant. Now it's sort of just like an inanimate thing that's part of the furniture. So it's like, you can use that to recontextualize it now. You can make it into your own thing.
That's a big part of Adam Curtis's work, the most recent BBC series.
Yeah, I haven't even seen that yet,
amazing.
To see that.
Were you a fan of his work?
Yeah, like a little bit. No, I didn't actually know too much other than hypernormalization, but it was interesting because I talked to him and he was like, I'm doing this thing about cosplaying and about how it started with like the gay voguing. So that was just funny how it came about. I don't know, he was just saying things that were in my head a lot and it was just nice to, I don't even know if I said that I was in the band or something. I just was talking to, like, I was just talking to him. I think I was just trying to grill him a bit as well, like, a bit drunk, probably a bit smart, like, be controversial with him or something. But he was cool.
Obviously, when we pulled into the car park at the MC Hotel, directly from House in the Woods, that evening that we've talked about already. I have said before, we pulled into the car park, which is underground. It was, very parallax view, very All the President's Men kind of car park. And just literally the Small Bottle Flowers finished. And he went, that's the song that I really like, which tacitly felt to me, that's the only song I like, kind of thing. You know? And he wasn't so brutal as to say anything else. But I did read between those lines. I may be wrong, maybe right. I think he liked a bit of No Surface or Feeling because it had a tiny bit of the Pumpkins element to it. And he was a big fan of the Pumpkins. But I got that feeling that he liked something that you could see with the darkness that withered away and then he died in the song. Something purer died, kind of thing. So I wasn't sure after that moment, and it did feel like a moment because he said it very, very directly. After that moment, I remember thinking this could be a bit of a, this could be one of those albums where I suppose, you know, well, why I said, you know, in many interviews after the Bible, you know, I let Richie run with the ball on this one. He had a vision. I remember thinking to myself, well, perhaps that's what Richie's going to say on this record, that this isn't quite my vision, but like, you know, I'm still in the band, you know? You know, Nick was, why I was very magnanimous on the Bible of saying, you know, Richie's written 70% of these lyrics, you know, and this is vision, lyrically. So I thought perhaps I'll switch around now. The polarity of that will switch around to perhaps Nick writing more words. Then when we came to do the master version, I think we were careful not to change it too much in terms of the structure or the words, though there's a few tweaks. But that's where Mike Hedges and Ian Grimble, so Ian Grimble was the engineer and Mike was the producer. That's where real production comes out, where it just felt so full of quality, full of crystalline clear detail. It was reserved. He got the right performance out of me. And he got Frank Sinatra's harp player. Can't believe I've forgotten her name. Fuck, sorry. She did an amazing job. It was just two passes and she just did it. And she was lovely. She said, oh, I love this song. You know, this song could have, is very 60s. And I remember saying something about The Spider and the Fly, which is a Stones song, which I had in my head too. So, yeah, we were careful to be faithful to it because of what Richie had said beforehand, definitely. Yeah.
So I wanted to talk a bit about Design for Life, because obviously that's, it's a pivotal point of the record, and it's just such a, I don't know, it's a pivotal point of your life, isn't it? You described it in the, I've read it described as Trojan Horse Manix, a radio-friendly, milkman-hummable song that delivers a very clear political message. I just wondered, how does it feel writing something like that after all the things that happened? Was that cathartic? Was that redemption?
Well, kind of number one, why I was writing in a very different way. He was writing within some kind of meter, which was more easily sung. That was obvious straight away. There's still lines in there which literally hit you in the face, you know. You know, if right here in my dirty face, right here in my pretty face. You know, there's still lines that just, and that's really struck me. I was playing with the boys the other day in the studio. We're going through lots of old songs like Next Day to Leave Moscow, Rose in the Hospital, just lots of old stuff that we haven't played for ages. And, you know, one of the first lines in Rose in the Hospital is, Rose in the Hospital, I tried to put my fingernails out. Woo, hit! And so you've got this song where, you know, we hang our hopes on it, but it's still got lines in there like, you know, if I had a bottle right here in my dirty face, it's still very, very oppositional. It still kind of startles you a bit as a lyric. But the song, you know, when I got those lyrics and, you know, I thought it was so succinct that we didn't really need another verse either. We just changed one word in the next verse from dirty to pretty, obviously. I remember thinking it was about, you know, bust and boom economy, economic policies. It was about a kind of the long traditional tirade to kind of like, you know, keep the working classes in their place in terms of their ambitions and their spending power, and keep them reined with fear in terms of just, you know, the erosion of like the erosion of union rights, et cetera, et cetera. It was all in there. And there was a real beautiful, gentle pride in there. Yeah, you know, it was a proud lyric, but not like proud with your chest stuck out. It was something that glided. And I remember thinking, you know, this is it. You know, he's managed to distill it all down. You know, after coming off the back of an album like Yes, where you sometimes you're having history lessons, which I loved. But we had to take a turn somewhere else. It had to be more distilled. We had to try and repurpose everything we knew about ourselves. And this lyric did it, you know. And it did it in a really overarching kind of way, I think.
And at the time, were there any plans to do anything else with it? You know, was there going to be a follow-up or maybe, you know, something to do with TV? Or,
Yes, there have been multiple different sort of. We've been approached to make a TV series. We were cooking that for out in LA for a while, and we were a lot of people were interested in turning it into a narrative series, and so we were working on that for a while. We had meetings with HBO. We went to the Sundance Episodic Lab and did that. It was incredible, and we worked with all these showrunners out there, and you know, trying to work up a pilot and a season for a you know, whatever, like a some cable series, you know. And we pitched HBO, Netflix, and everybody, and we got close, you know. We got close, and but that didn't happen. But that's still cooking in new versions. There's new, and then there's even been recently people approached us about doing a narrative or recreating the doc as a narrative film or as a movie.
Would that be with you guys again, or with actors, or?
Well, that was the thing. I was like, there's no way. I was like, well, what do you mean? Like because. The DNA of like, I wouldn't ever want to hire like cast it with some like a Tom type character and a me type character in I wouldn't ever want it to be like any national music. So I the thing is like if the premise and the narrative and the story that happens that was really makes it a great movie. I feel like someone could. I said maybe it's not, you know, it's sisters. You know, I do think that the siblings thing is critical to the story. You know,
yeah, completely.
So, but it does seem like a pretty hard challenge to turn that into a Hollywood movie. And so I'm interested to see what might develop there. But I'm not leading that. You know. And Tom, you know, Tom and I aren't leading that, but there is that kind of thing. But yeah, we're all still very interested, possibly in, I don't know, just the Tom and I have so much fun when we're together, and Tom has been filming me doing everything I've been doing since the end of that movie. You know, so we've got 12
part weeks. Two.
Well, we've got 11 years of more story, Tom's story. You know, Tom's story since the end of the movie, he's had a serious roller coaster of 10 years. So have I, and Tom. You know, and a lot of it was Tom was. I mean, Tom has shot like 10 videos for me. You know, in the past 10 years, there is possibly if Kryn and Tom and I buckled down. We could probably do a pretty honest and genuine, good follow up to that, but it took like two years to edit, you know, or felt like it, I don't know how long it felt like it was a long slow, the editing process, you know, is it with documentaries? I think it's such a the editing is so that's the storytelling is all the editing and so yeah we're collecting and we'll see if we make it to the end.
And what did your parents think of the film? I thought it was really sweet that they were willing to be in the film.
My poor sister Rachel was not in it except for the photo and we've both been. She's held that over us for a long time. When she saw it, she lived in Seattle. The next one, she'll be in a lot more. But my parents are incredible. They have always encouraged all of us just to do whatever made us happy. That was it. And they believed even when we weren't happy. They're like, you're going to be, like, you know, you will be happy. You know, we won't let you not be happy, you know, and it's true.
Yeah.
They have three happy kids, you know, I mean, not always happy, but my parents are the best. They're incredible. Yeah.
And just before we came on stage, I said, oh, that's amazing. Werner Herzog's in the film, who is my favorite film director.
Yeah.
And you promised me to tell me the story behind it.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, no, the Werner Herzog thing, that was all real. The cast of Lost couldn't get in. Werner and his wife, his partner, they couldn't get in. But they got in and they saw the show. But before, yeah, so yeah, Werner Herzog was one of my favorite filmmakers too. And at the time, there was we were talking about maybe doing a. He wanted to do a video, but he wanted to shoot us on the edge of a live volcano. it was really true. He had it all planned out, and I think he thought we had like a couple $100,000 for a video budget. You know, he wasn't sure. You know, and we were like, we can't go to a volcano. You know, and so we never did do a video with Werner, but I had a great dinner with him, and we had I remember the band and Werner and his wife and the bunch of the Lost cast members all had like a, you know, we were 10 of us around a big table at a Japanese restaurant, and I mean they did the huge platter, you know, 25 person platter of sushi all along the middle. And so there's all this like, and I was kind of too nervous to eat because it was about an hour and a half before the show, and I can never eat before the show. And so there's all this kind of warming sushi, you know, over the course of this long dinner. And Werner was talking to everybody. He was right across from me, and he was in a phase where he was very obsessed with serial killers. So he was talking about all like John Wayne Gacy and all these serial, and he was just into the details of all these serial killers. Well, there's all this like sort of warming sushi in front of us. And then I forget his partner's name. And she was right next to me, and she was talking to me about all her photography. And she does a lot of, all her photography is fetuses in jars from like around the world. I mean, she does a lot of beautiful, amazing thing, but like one, so she was showing me all these photos of fetuses in jars and from science labs and hospitals, old ones, you know, from that have been in jars for you know, 100 years or something. So I remember just like all this sushi, Werner talking about serial killers, and then all these fetuses in jars. Yeah, it was one of those dinners that I'll never forget.
One of those ones.
But he's so funny and so sweet, and so is she. And that was a fun night, even though it looked like a disaster.
The reason this changed my life was that it made me confront something. Like every time I went back there, no matter, you know, I played some of the greatest venues in the world, and I've been incredibly lucky with my professional life. But going back there reduced me to this 5-year-old kid that had kind of been the foundation, I think, of my life, and it was defining me in ways that I didn't know. And you know, I'd battled drugs in the 90s and alcohol. You know, I did heroin, whatever, you name it, you know. And then, you know, I did therapy, and I did Primal Scream therapy, which was really wild, and AA and NA and all that stuff. But I didn't know why I had this compulsion to take things. I had to go to the kind of final end of things. Like for me, the way that I gave up was alcohol and drugs was I said, okay, I'm getting on the plane. My friend had died. I couldn't face the funeral. I got on the plane and I'd been in on a couch pissing myself and like, you know, I was in a mess. And I just said, look, if I wake up in Paris and I'm alive, I'm giving up. That's just the kind of way that I operate. It's all or nothing. I woke up and I said, okay, this is when I stop. And anyone having problems, the only way that you will stop is when you decide yourself. That's the only way I've ever found myself personally, is to make that promise to yourself that you will. You can't do it for anybody or anything else. It has to be for you. And that's, for me, was the first step I didn't realize of actually caring about myself, which I found very hard to do. Most of my life, I found that very difficult. And music was a way for me to kind of escape the real world. And it was like the greatest thing, the greatest gift for me was to just immerse myself in music. And that's what I've done until now. I'm 60. So yeah, I was quite extreme in that sense. You know, I had to kind of give myself this ultimatum. I woke up and I cleaned up. But I hadn't, I don't know, I did a lot of therapy and stuff, and I could never work out why my foundation was so shattered and why I seemed to be defined by this stuff that I had no control over. Like, why would I meet somebody and 24 hours later decide to follow them around to the other side of the world, and when they're not there, sink into a depression at 21 and think, like, why am I so fucking needy? So there was a lot of stuff. And then I realized, I'm sorry, this is a long answer to a very simple question, but it is a Q&A. So it's one question, one answer. And stop me if this is driving anyone crazy, because we can talk about what I feed the dogs or something. But I realized getting in the car that it was like just getting in a time machine, and everything twisted inside me, and suddenly I wasn't this guy. You know, I wasn't that guy. Like, I was kind of this person that I knew that I didn't know how to navigate things, and Justin saw me spin out of control really quickly, and he just said, okay, look. And I will be grateful to him for the rest of my life for this. He said, listen, we've got the crew here. We can go there, see what happens. You're at a really important moment in your life. I had all this stuff going on. I was separating. I'd fallen in love. I had a lot of stuff, just life stuff, but it was all going on. And I was playing to 10,000 people a night. I basically sort of had this monumental fucking breakdown in the car, and he just said, listen, you're at an important time in your life. I would encourage you to be open to this. Now, this guy just thought we were going back to shoot a couple of things in Ballarat, me eating fish and chips and all this stuff, and he's got this person having a, you know, total existential crisis. And I called Andrew Dominic, who I've worked with on several films, The Assassination of Jesse James, Blonde, the two documentaries, the one on Nick, When His Son Dies, One More Time with Feeling, and This Much I Know to Be True. And I called Andrew and I said, fuck, Andrew, I don't know what to do. Like, Justin's asking something from me that I can't do. And he just said, trust him, trust the process, throw yourself into it, you will get something out of it. And so on the strength of that, I did. Now, what Justin did was he enabled me enough room. I mean, there was a lot of stuff that he took out of the film, because – you know, I don't know if anyone's been through this, but when you have some trauma in your childhood, you can just run away from it, which is what I did, and just let it build up. And one day a big tsunami of shit will fall on you, and then you have to deal with it. And I guess that had been part of my reasoning for just obliterating myself all the time. I think, I don't really know, but Justin was amazing. He just said, where did you feel safe? And I just said, well, the gardens, there was this statue I loved, and the church, I really loved that there, and the countryside, and the cinema. And he said, okay, let's go and play there. And he took me, and I thought it was kind of naff. And then I just thought, okay, I'm going to trust him. And it was amazing, because in some way he enabled me to reclaim these places as a 58-year-old guy.
So you mentioned earlier your frustration with the music industry. So going back further in your career, you started writing music when you were very young, and you were, I guess, sort of discovered on YouTube from covering songs. What drew you to music at such a young age? And the need to sort of put them out into the world?
What drew me to it was my family. My dad taught me guitar. Mum was playing piano. My brother played guitar. We all sang together. Not in that kind of mama's and papa's way, in like, you know, a casual private way.
Were they folk musicians? Did they play in clubs or anything?
So no, nobody in the family had ever played professionally. So I was the first one that kind of took it too far. And yeah, the YouTube thing was accidental. We also did not understand the scope of that website. So at the time it was genuinely just so my grandparents could watch a video. They lived in France at the time and had the internet. So it was a very unassuming thing. I didn't know that being a musician was a career necessarily. I was confused as to how that could be a job. And I was, you know, well, in the beginning I was 12, and then I got sort of scouted at 14, and then I signed to Sony at 15. So it very much happened to me, but not without my consent.
And how was that for you entering the music industry at such a young age? I mean, that's a very young age to be
doing anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't comprehend that at all.
What were you doing at 14?
I was at school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Well, I was reading Simon Armitage poetry.
Right. Yeah, me too. I was also at school, and I also made sure to finish it. And I did my GCSEs and I did my A-levels, and I went on tour, but I took my revision. And it was a half life, a secret life. I kept it quite low-key at home and would disappear from school a few times a week and go down to London, talk on the radio and come back. But I don't know, I kind of blocked out a lot of that time because you think you're much older than you are at the time. But I feel very distant from it now. It's, you know, like all of our origin stories or what we do as teenagers, it's kind of like a distant memory of idiocy.
And how did you consider doing anything else other than music? Or was it a case that this came along just so early that that was the only track that you were going to be on?
Yeah, I guess I never really had the opportunity to discover anything else. You know, I never went for apprenticeships. So I never was interning. I knew that it was going to be books or music. I always wanted to be a music supervisor, still do. If anyone can hire me, I am here. Yeah, there was no part of me that wasn't going to be somewhere connected to music.
So how do you look back on that part of your career? You said you sort of tried to almost block it out, as most of us do in our awkward teenage years. Do you find it more helpful with distance, or do you try not to be too reflective?
I think one day I'll do a big write-up about it. But no, I think distance is great. It's just not a part of me that I find very interesting. You know, it's like I just tried things musically and they were public, and that's kind of it, really. And I was discovering myself.
Is there any advice you'd give to people, you know, young artists who are starting off? Is there anything you'd be able to pass on?
Well, I think I get asked this a lot and I never really provide a good answer, and it makes me think that I should really prep this one. Everybody says trust your gut, but I didn't think that's a very good thing to say, because your gut can lie to you on a daily basis. I don't think we know what that means. I would say find your people first and kind of expand your circle, so you're always surrounded by good people that kind of inspire you and, you know, love you before you go out on your own. I think I certainly was lacking a kind of community, and I would have felt a lot more self-assured, and there would have been a lot more discussion that wasn't internal. around things like first gigs, first radios, first albums, all the firsts. I think if I had my mates with me at the time, it would have been a bit sweeter.
How do you think this record compares to UK Grimm? Does it feel angrier or more resigned or clearer to you?
I think it's more resigned. I think it's more, I don't know if the word laid back is right. I think it's more grown up. I've done a lot of growing up over the last 2 years. You know, I want to get to a point where I don't give a fuck what people think about me. And I think it's healthy to have some concern about what people think about you, because if not, then, you know, you'd go insane and you'd do horrible things to people. But it's like, my problem was, you know, being trounced on by fucking whoever and letting it carry around for days and days. I needed to understand this about myself, and I'm over that now. Do you know what I mean? So this all sounds like I'm making it about me, you know, because we're addressing things in the world where I can't even contemplate how people are going through certain things. But I think you have to make it about yourself initially before you can take it out to the outside world. Do you know what I mean? That's just how it is, you know.
And there are several collaborations on the album. There's Sue Tompkins from Life Without Buildings, Gwendoline Christie, Aldous Harding, Liam Bailey, Snowy, Big Special. How did all of these come about?
Just a lot of it was down to this time around with guests has been more about, okay, I can't sing this. I know somebody that can, particularly with Aldous Harding and Liam Bailey. I needed those voices, those sonics on the track to make it work. So in effect, they were almost like instruments, you know what I mean? As regards Gwendoline, Sue Tompkins, they were more feature-based. And that isn't to sound detrimental towards the other people. Of course, they're features as well. But, you know, they kind of almost fit in with the song like a strand of DNA that needs replacing, you know what I mean? Mm. Whereas, you know, Sue Tompkins and Gwendoline, they sit on top of the track and they are more, you know, it's more obvious that they are a complete and utter guest. Do you know what I mean? So it was a bit of half and half, really.
Was it particularly special working with Sue Tompkins? Are you a big fan of Life Without Buildings?
Yeah, I've just got off the phone with her, actually.
Oh.
No, I wasn't a fan, actually. Jeanette Lee from Rough Trade sort of suggested, look, we used to work with this band called Life Without Buildings, and we think Sue, the singer, might be a great collaborator. And so, and it went from there, really.
And did you have any expectations with certain artists?
No. The only expectation was that they would do it in about 10 minutes, and they did. All of them did it in about 10 to 15 minutes. I mean, probably, you know, all right, I'll put a tab of realism on there, probably about half an hour, you know what I mean? But the idea was to have the idea laid down for them already. And, you know, that's normally how we work. We've got something written, you know, there are occurrences where people come in with original material. Amy Taylor did when we collaborated with her, you know, to a certain degree. Tor Maris did a Billy No Mates. She had a verse there that she'd written, etc. So, but yeah, mostly on this one, mostly all of it was, most of it anyway, was already written.
And do you really enjoy collaborating with people? Because obviously you have quite a history of that.
Yeah, it's hard work in the sense that you don't know these people, and it's a case of, you know, it can be quite nervy, you know, especially if they're, you know, particularly with people like Gwendoline Christie, whose reputation precedes her. She is an absolute presence in the world of creativity. So, yeah, even though I wasn't nervous, actually, it's just like it's quite awkward, isn't it? And again, taking this back to COVID, is that part of that, or have I always been, you know, not very good at communicating with people? But or feel like I am anyway. But no, you know, obviously, me and Andrew have written these songs, and these people come in, and it's done very professionally. So of course, we communicate well with people.